Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there from Los Angeles. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the Mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got an interview with Michael Goldstein, aka Bitstein, co-host of the Noded podcast and president of the Nakamoto Institute. But before that, I have a message from my amazing sponsors. Please do check them out. It's because of the sponsors that I'm able to get out and do all these great interviews. So first up, we have Wire, and thank you to everyone who's taken the time to check them out. I caught up with Dunny last week to find out how the campaign's been going, to find out if it's made a difference, if it's moved the needle, and he told me they've had a massive uplift in inquiries. So that is super cool. Thank you to everyone who has helped make this campaign work for them. So why should you be checking out Wire? Well, they have been helping companies across the space with Bitcoin onboarding since 2013. It doesn't matter whether you are a solo developer or a massive team. If you are looking to simplify user onboarding, if you want to give your users a fast, easy, and badass way to purchase Bitcoin, then you need to talk to Wire. They take care of all the heavy lifting, all the pain in the ass items such as compliance, payments, and liquidity, so you can focus on building your core offering. Your idea could be the next killer app, so do not let those regulators kill it. If you want to find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account at sendwire.com, which is sendwyre.com. And next up, we have the amazing Dropbit. The amazing Dropbit. The best mobile wallet in the business for Bitcoin. And you know what? Thousands of you have been downloading it because of this ad. So thank you to everyone who supports Dropbit and supports the podcast by checking them out. I was in Ohio last week. I caught up with the team and they were telling me about all the amazing things that are coming in 2020. They are crushing it. Absolutely fucking crushing it. So if you haven't downloaded it, if you haven't checked it out, now's the time to do it. Why? Well, they've got Lightning support. They've got Batch32 address support. They've got onboarding within the app. You can tweet Bitcoin. You can text Bitcoin. You can do so much with Bitcoin in this app. If you haven't checked it out, head over to dropbit.app. It's available for the iPhone and Android. That's dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. And also, if you've got a Lightning wallet, if it isn't unlocked, I've got you covered. Just hit me up on Twitter. I'll send you some sats and get that Lightning wallet unlocked for you. Also, I want to give a massive shout out to my man Leon in London and his amazing conference, Advancing Bitcoin, which I will be the MC for. This isn't a paid ad. I just know Leon is doing some amazing stuff and I want him to crush it with this conference. I want it to be a sellout. So if you want to come out to London, hang out with me on February the 6th and 7th, get a local beer, get some pie and chips, make sure you are at Advancing Bitcoin. The speaker list is insane. They've got Andrew Polster, who's twice been on my podcast. You've got Andrew Chow, Jimmy Song, Nicholas Dorey, and also you've got Blockstream, Chaincode Labs, Square Crypto, and Wasabi Wallet. Leon is killing it. So I'm definitely excited to be part of this. Check it out at advancingbitcoin.com, and if you use the discount code Peter, you can get 10% off your ticket. Okay, so on to the interview, and finally, yes, finally, I've got Michael Goldstein on the podcast. Mr. Bitstein himself, the co-host of the Noded podcast, along with Pierre Rochard, the president of Nakamoto Institute, and the meme master. He killed it this year with Bitcoin Fixes It. It is the meme of 2019. So I was out in Texas, and I was like, come on, Michael, it's well overdue you coming on the podcast. Let's do this. And I had so many questions for him. So we got started on libertarianism, and about 90 minutes in, I realized I hadn't even touched any other questions. So there for next time, because we went pretty deep down the rabbit hole with this. And you know, after my recent shows with Stefan Levera, Safety Namus, and Eric Voorhees, where I was looking at libertarianism, I've still got questions that remain unanswered. I don't fully understand the transition to a full anarcho-capitalist society or even a minarchist society, which is something Francis Poulier has talked about. So I had some questions around this and I threw them all at Michael and he batted them back like a legend. So it was a great chat. I hope you enjoyed it. I loved it. If you've got any questions about the show, do hit me up. It's hello at whatbitcoindid.com. Also, this trip is coming to a close. I didn't get to everywhere I wanted to. The trip kept changing for a bunch of reasons, but I've got two more interviews today in LA. Tomorrow I'm going to be heading out to see Lynn Ulbrich, finding out how Ross is and recording a show with her for Defiance. I'm also going to be heading back to Austin, maybe, perhaps Florida. Even Boston might be on the cards before I go to New York and home. Got to see how the next few days plans out, see who's available for interviews. And also, Thanksgiving's coming, and it looks like everyone is busy. Anyway, next month I'll also be out in Uruguay for the BitConf, and I think I'm going to go via Argentina. I think I'm going to check out Buenos Aires. So if anyone wants a Bitcoin meetup there, do let me know. And as ever, if you've got any questions, feel free to hit me up.
Finally, Michael on the podcast, Bitstein on the podcast. Good to have you, man. So what are your favorite altcoins?
What is it? My five favorite altcoins, definitely Tron, Chainlink, Aurora Coin.
I can't believe
you gotta put Dogecoin in there.
Dogecoin. I haven't got anything. I've got all the shit I've been given. And that's it. I've got some Ripple I've never converted to Bitcoin yet. When it goes up to $567.
You're a bag holder. I'm sure it'll go up again at some point. Maybe. We got to make Garlinghouse the richest man in the world again.
Well, it's the utter stupidity. Look, we're going to get into talking about altcoins now, because I was going to go, yeah, but they're selling off 400 million. No, let's not talk about this. Let's talk about Bitcoin fixing things. So I missed, I was meant to be in, it was in Dallas, right?
Yeah, BitBlock Boom. Yeah, remember you were on the list.
Yeah, my kids, I'd been traveling a lot back and forth, and they kind of got a bit fed up, and I was like, oh, we're going to go on holiday to America, and by the way, I've got to go to a conference, and they were a bit like, oh. So I said, okay. So I let them know I couldn't go, and we went to Vietnam, but it sounds like I missed a really good event.
It was a very good event. I mean, first thing I'll say, family is more important. You know, the purpose, the reason that we're into Bitcoin is not that Bitcoin is the end itself. It's because of what we believe that Bitcoin enables. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of us, having families and a prosperous life and peace and all of that, that's why we're in it. So no hard feelings for missing out on the conference, but it was an extraordinary conference.
I confess, I still not watched your presentation. Like, I know what's going to be in it, right?
Hey, you know, a lot of the haters didn't watch it either, so.
Well, that's the same. That's, you know, the haters. Well, the haters tend to do two things. Like, I like the haters I get before a show's released. I'm like, you haven't heard it yet. Listen to it first. Or my favorite haters are the ones that go, oh, I listened to your show, it's fucking bullshit. And they do that every show. So they keep listening and keep coming back and saying it's bullshit, see?
Right, which just gives you more ad money.
But you're a nice guy, man. You're like a really nice guy, and you went out there and triggered the fuck out of a lot of people.
Right. Yes. Really. Well, you know, I do enjoy mass triggerings. So, you know, in person, I am nice. I think online, I am nice. I can be aggressive sometimes. Although there's fewer types of arguments I like to get into online.
You don't Twitterify. Anyway.
Not as much anymore. I used to back in 2013 through 2016, I was really in there with a prison shank, just, mm-hmm. you know, stabbing anything wall. Around. Yeah. But
I'm trying to wean myself off it.
Yeah. And I guess actually when I have deleted my Twitter account a couple times, and I came back actually around UASF, that was sort of a beacon to me of like, oh, I need to be out there, you know, fighting the good fight. And I guess I would have to go back and look at my Twitter history. I'm sure I was getting into plenty of nice battles then.
But when you delete your account, don't you lose everything?
I did at the time. Now, it was
now
purposeful.
It would be risky, though.
My Twitter account is way bigger than it had ever been. Uh-huh. I mean, I brought back the Twitter account prior to the 2017 bull run. Uh-huh. So UASF was, of course, much before that. So that really bolstered the account, because a few choice tweets, choice shit posts on the way up just kept really bringing in the followers and stuff. And
you're more of a retweeter.
I go through phases,
right? Okay.
You know, and sometimes there's a lull. You know, you don't always have necessarily something new to say. At least I don't. So you know, every time that there's a fun, you know, really cool technical thing going on, I'm gonna want to retweet it. You know, guys at Bitcoin OpTech even pointed out to me that I'm like, they reliably know that like Pierre and I are going to be retweeting their stuff, because the technical stuff is very important. And you know, Pierre is just constantly putting out good content, and just like, I just want to, you know, signal boost good content. But occasionally I'll get into the mode where it's like I have my fight that I'm trying to make. I'm trying to craft, you know, certain ideas. And that's when I go hard in the paint, I guess.
And you've got Pierre closer to you now.
Working on it. He's not in Austin yet, but he'll be here soon.
Does that mean more noted shows?
Yes. We really want to set up a studio and everything and make it serious, because why not shitpost 24/7 if possible?
The Daily Noted.
Yes. My whole life I've always had, you know, opinions that don't resonate with everyone. So I'm used to people disagreeing with me. And I've also, because of that, I think had a joy in having people disagree with me, given that I'm, you know, if I actually believe I'm right, well, then what's the issue with them disagreeing with me?
What's the background to you and Pierre? Because you have this amazing relationship.
Yeah, we met at the University of Texas. Uh-huh. So there was a group called Libertarian Longhorns at the University of Texas, which was, I was connected to a lot of the college libertarian groups, and I will put my foot down that Libertarian Longhorns was the best libertarian group out of them all. And from that, we also had a spinoff group that I'd started called the Mises Circle that was focused on Austrian economics.
Okay.
And I think Pierre found us through one of our Facebook groups and was getting into fights with some of the people on there. So naturally, we got along very well.
Yeah.
We both came from that same sort of anarcho-capitalist, Austro-libertarian background. And we're both, you know, a bit trollish in just our nature. So we got along very quickly and very well. And the Mises Circle also was where all of our Bitcoin stuff started. Mm-hmm. So we've just been fighting in the trenches of Bitcoin since the day we learned about it.
Right, okay. So let's talk about the libertarian stuff, because I'm new to the libertarian rabbit hole. So I just I drove the other day from New York to Ohio, which is an awful, boring drive. I didn't realize at the time. I like to do on these trips a couple of big drives so I can do some podcasts and do some audiobooks. And I finally did economics in one lesson. Mm-hmm. I skipped some of the chapters. They seemed a bit out of date, but very useful. And I listened to probably 30 Tom Woods episodes.
Uh-huh.
So, and I'm right now regularly fighting on Facebook with my friends regarding a lot of the political debate at the moment, because we've got an election coming up. We've got Brexit. And so today, Labour released their manifesto. I don't know if you know about this, but there's a lot of quite left, well, far left socialist policies, and then renationalization and a huge increase in corporation tax, a lot of new socialist policies. So I'm sat there now in my new trench. I'm not comfortable debating on Twitter because there's a lot of smart people there, but I'm on Facebook arguing with people saying this is bullshit, doesn't make sense, it's dangerous, and I'm getting a lot of flack back. And people think I'm nasty now. They think, like, I had two people call me and one text me concerned about my welfare. They think I've become some, like, nasty Nazi. Have you experienced that?
Not that much, although I have quite the bubble. So, like, I just hang out with libertarians, and most of my friends have been libertarians since, you know, probably even late high school. So
right.
I don't really deal with that too much. But there has been a trend where it's, you know, anyone who's outside of status quo, there are certain words that they want to use to just label it all. And it's very unfortunate because it obviously poisons the well of debate. But that's also the purpose of it, because it just wants to shut down opinion rather than have a discussion. And from their perspective, I guess there's some... The reason is because they have their own slippery slope visions of how things could turn. Like, if you start to allow this kind of thing, you end up with, you know, concentration camps. The same way that, you know, they might view, you know, libertarians, or libertarians might actually have, which is, if you start to allow this, you're going to end up with concentration camps. So everyone has, like, their slippery slope visions, yep. And so they kind of want to cut it off at the pass. So I get why they think that, but it's also, for someone like me, I like, you know, intellectual kind of freedom and discourse and stuff, and I don't get afraid of various ideas, and I can handle contemplating them without, you know, necessarily taking on all of the conclusions and incorporating into my life. Like,
yeah,
day to day, no matter what I'm kind of contemplating at the moment, whether it's because I was, like, you know, digging into some, you know, Marxist type stuff, or if I was reading some, like, hardcore libertarian, or even, you know, other stuff. You know, day to day, I'm still just like a normal guy going about my business, and I'm able to contemplate that, but I can't really, like, I don't want to, like, psychoanalyze other people, but no. I assume they have a certain fear of other people playing with these ideas because of where they think those ideas would lead.
Yeah, I also think there's a certain conditioning. So I'll take it from a personal perspective pre-Bitcoin, not 2013 when I was using the Silk Road. Like, let's go from 2017 when I first really started having an interest and then doing the podcast and reading. To me, politics was left or right or centre, right? So you're very much a left-wing socialist or you were a right-wing conservative, but with a bunch of people who maybe have kind of centrist ideas. But at no point had... So when I studied economics, we have something called A-level, which is like senior school. At no point in economics did we ever get introduced to Austrian economics.
Right.
It was Keynesian economics.
Right.
That's all we were taught. And right. He was lauded as like a hero of economics.
Yeah, and this is why, like, you know, you mentioned Tom Woods. Mm. He talks about like the index card of allowable opinion. Love you know, that. In political theory, they call that the Overton window, which mm-hmm. is these are the sort of types of opinions that you can have in polite society. And as soon as you step out of that, you know, people get really upset, perhaps for some good reasons, perhaps for so many bad reasons. But
I don't think some people have been exposed sometimes to alternative ideas.
Right. And that's, you know, the unfortunate thing is like something like Austrian economics, as soon as they hear it, because it's outside of that, they also assume that it's some kind of evil thing. Or for instance, like...
Or a subgroup.
You take any government program, whether it's some kind of socialized healthcare, and I don't mean just like what Britain has. I mean, I would call the United States socialist healthcare as well. Any time that the government's getting involved in wanting to control the production of something, or you know, public education, or you know what have you, people's responses is effectively, but what about my roads? So it's like, who's going to build the roads? And they assume, or you know, oh, you just want children to die. Like, you don't care about the children.
Yes.
Because you don't want to educate them. And it's like, no, I no one said anything about not wanting to educate them. It's them. I don't think the government is best at providing that education. But unfortunately, there is that divide where they assume the worst once you've stated that you don't like how the government does it. They assume that you don't like that service altogether. Which is also why, like, you know, oh, you're an anarcho-capitalist, you hate the law or whatever. No, it's actually, I like law. I like law and order. I just see how the government handles things, and we can point to endless cases of them not handling the situation very well for systemic reasons.
Ross Ulbricht.
Ross Ulbricht is a great example.
My first visit to Austin nearly 2 years ago was to interview Lynn Ulbricht here in the city. And I think what you're saying is, let's punish aggression, murder, rape, violence, fraud, but let's not punish somebody for smoking weed.
Right. Well, and even in Ross's case, I mean, my understanding of the Catherine Forrester's actual ruling as judge was effectively, we're throwing you in jail for double life plus 40 because of your philosophy. Mm-hmm. So it was merely like, that's practically his thought crime. It wasn't because he himself was engaging in these behaviors. In fact, like the Silk Road itself had law, by the way, mm-hmm. In the sense that you were not allowed to sell stolen goods, anything involving like, you know, the harm of children and stuff like that.
Well, I take a slightly different view on Ross, a more practical view. And I asked Lynn this question, actually. My view is that whether or not I agree with the laws of the land, they exist. Mm-hmm. And for my own protection, I will certainly abide by some of them. So, like, I don't smoke weed because it doesn't agree with me, but I don't have any issue with it. If I wanted to smoke a spliff at home, I would. I certainly wouldn't buy a pound of weed for a friend and hand it over, even if I believe philosophically it's fine, because I don't want to risk. So one of the questions I put to Lynn is, like, you know, Ross did commit crimes, certain crimes under the law. So, for example, because he wouldn't have been paying tax, you know, essentially his money laundering. So should he face punishment? And as I remember, I think she said yes, but time served now would be fair.
Right. My understanding of Ross, I haven't really interacted with him much personally or anything like that. But from what I know about Ross, had they given him, like, you know, the slaps on the wrist, he would go back to normal life and never, you know, cause harm again. So the fact that they felt the need to throw him in a cage until his bones rot, like, just, like, disintegrate into nothingness, is justified does not, to me, as a libertarian, that doesn't strike me as law and order, especially when all kinds of other people are getting away with all kinds of terrible things and no one bats an eye. We see, I forget his name, the guy, the DA in San Francisco now, who literally worked for Hugo Chavez and is saying he's not going to prosecute all kinds of various street crimes. And yet they want to, like, you know, oh, let's focus on the corporations and stuff. So it's like, you know, tech is the evil thing, and it's okay if everyone's causing crime. So it's like, can we call that law and order? I mean, it's the DA that's, like, putting down the edict. And I guess if you have a what's called legal positivism, which is, like, what the law of the land says is the way it goes, then if he says that this is how things are, then it is. But I think it's right for some people to also look towards what can they make sense of how law ought to work and give their input. But there is also something to be said about, you know, not purposefully causing any alarms to go off.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do drugs. I don't recommend people do drugs. I don't want the government to, I don't like the war on drugs, not because I want people to be doing drugs and selling drugs. I actually, part of me finds it annoying that I'm going to have to, like, deal with the smell of weed more in my life as it gets more legalized. But at the same time, you know, I recognize what are the costs of having the war on drugs, which has just, you know, been massive. You get people thrown in jail way more than they should. Mm-hmm. You know, the goods still are valued. So there, you know, there's just going to be a creation of a black market, which has all kinds of other issues. There's extra legal violence and more, you know, money laundering is a different thing, but there's financial things that go under the radar and stuff. Like, it's a mess, and you don't help by making these things illegal.
Well, if you look at the change in the U.S. with, you know, depending on state, but the majority of states have now either legalized or decriminalized, society has not collapsed.
Right.
You know, and it's professionalized it. I went out to Bitcoin Mum's shop in Colorado, Jack Mallers Mum's, and recorded a show. But, you know, it's professionalized it. Before, you'd meet in a car park and meet a drug dealer, yeah, and there'd be an hour late and piss you around, and you wouldn't know if you get the right amount. But now it's,
and
like,
who knows if they've laced it with something.
Yeah. I mean, that's less of a problem with weed. But certainly, I don't know how much you know of my backstory, but I was a cocaine addict. And that certainly had a problem. You didn't know what it was laced with. The Silk Road was a godsend for a couple of reasons. Firstly, you had, because of the review system, the free market in operation, you were more reassured about what you were buying. So that was the first thing. You were more reassured about the value of what you were buying. But actually, a side thing that a lot of people don't realize that became very helpful to me is, as I, like, sank into the depths of my addiction, I was actually using the forums for advice, saying, look, my body's doing this, I'm feeling this, and that's kind of when I realized I was fucked. But actually, that is the help I had that I needed in the environment I needed. You know, once that's gone, you bring back all the risks of a black market. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. And added to that also, so going back to the Facebook thing, like, Facebook's become a testing ground of ideas for me. Mm-hmm. Actually, Facebook and Twitter. So I don't... It's funny, some of the things I put out on Twitter or Facebook, I don't always believe it, but I use it as a testing ground for ideas to see responses. It becomes super useful. But Facebook has become a very interesting testing ground. So on some of the libertarian side of things, like, I'm interested in talking about it with you, because I think at the moment I consider myself maybe a moderate libertarian. Like, I like a lot of the philosophy. I think a lot of it's rational. The problem I have with, like, full anarchist libertarian is, and I've still not seen this proper explained, is essentially, how do we wean ourselves off the current system? You know, what is the process from where we are to the full anarcho-capitalistic society? And I can't see that. I've not had... Somebody might have explained it.
Right.
I talked about it with Eric Voorhees, and he talks about, actually, what we should strive for is, right now, just less government. 5%, 1%, and keep moving to less government, which to me feels responsible, because at least you can see the impact on society. And sorry, just, I'm throwing a lot in there. I just want to throw one other thing in with that. So when I was listening to that Economics in One Lesson, and the one lesson being that you don't look at the impact of a policy on a single group of people, you look at the impact on everyone.
Yeah.
If for anarcho-capitalist libertarian ideas, if there's the potential that it has a net negative on society and people, is there therefore potentially an argument for some form of collectivism? Do you understand the question?
Yeah, I think that a lot of these words are so loaded that, you know, even the term capitalism, I have a very specific definition of what I mean by it, but I see all kinds of people of various political persuasions that use that word in a completely different way. Some people use it to mean crony capitalism, and they mean it in a negative sense of, I don't like the crony capitalism. Some people use it in a positive sense, where they actually, like, support the, you know, they treat what we have in America as a free market, and they love the big businesses and stuff, and so they take that position. You have all these different loaded things, and even stuff like collectivism versus individualism. There's just so much loaded in there. And I think this is where Austrian economics is very useful and praxeology as a study, because what it does is simply, you know, first of all, the whole practice is value-free, meaning that it's a positive science. Yep. It is making positive claims about how the world operates. It's not saying good or bad. So in fact, someone could study praxeology and come out on the other hand wanting to be a socialist dictator and using what they learned about praxeology to best be a socialist dictator, because they know, if I want to siphon off wealth in this way, this is the best way to do it because of these praxeological principles.
Okay.
But are you familiar with the term praxeology?
No, I was just about to say, I was either going to ask you and think, right, I'm going to be, if there's another one of Pete's dumb questions, I'll just Google it afterwards.
No, I mean, this is, if you don't know it, I'm sure a lot of listeners don't as well. And so it's important to lay this out. So praxeology is the study of human action.
Okay.
Prax being action.
Practical.
So it's basically, you have, this was Ludwig von Mises developed praxeology basically as a way of formalizing how economics had always been done. He wasn't really necessarily trying to break through and say, this is the new way to do economics. You're just saying, this is how economics is done, and here's that epistemology of what we're actually doing here. What is it we're doing here? What he starts with is some simple axioms about human action. So human action is purposeful behavior. Every time you do something, it's because you're making a choice, you know, between A or not A, for whatever your reasons are. Now, it also has extreme subjectivism. So goods only have value because the individual can make use of it. And this comes from also a principle of methodological individualism, where you have to, like, even if you have a collective organization, that's still made up of individual humans who are acting as humans, you know, for their own purposes. They just happen to be doing it in a way that is coordinated, highly coordinated. So because of that, it's still individuals at work that form the collectivist entity.
Rather like enforced by the government.
Right. I mean, it can get to that point.
Of course.
I'm saying like that government itself, like the government as this big beast that is doing X, Y, and Z policies, that's still ultimately individuals. They've just found themselves in a certain, you know,
structure.
Complex structure that operates in that fashion, which I would say has negative consequences of various sorts. So when you get down to this and you just go with methodological individualism and subjective value and all of that, and you sort of rebuild your picture of things, I think it can help break through a lot of this. Another thing, though, is like, you know, when I think of anarcho-capitalism, I almost don't even think of it as an endpoint per se. In a sense, to me, anarcho-capitalism describes the world as it is. There is no, like, ultimate rule, and people use tools to achieve ends. All capital to me is it's not even necessarily a physical thing. Capital in a strict praxeological sense is just a good of some kind that is used for the purpose of producing other goods. So like memes are capital in a sense, because it allows better transmission of various ideas.
Okay.
So
intellectual
memes,
capital.
Yeah, that's capitalism to me. So like now we've broken it down, and that's what I mean by capitalism. So is there good ways of people using capital? Yes. Is there bad ways of using capital? Yes, because the government has capital, but they're clearly not using it in a way that respects certain things about private property that allows wealth to develop and society to flourish. So for me, you know, in going back to like, we're always in anarchy, like even between nations, there's a state of anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the you know, China and the United States are in a state of anarchy in relation to each other. And so you never really break out of that problem. It's just at like, what scales are you dealing with that problem? So from that perspective, like, to me, anarcho-capitalism, that's almost synonymous with natural law.
Mm-hmm.
What are the laws of economics that we can deduce from the principles of praxeology? And from praxeology, what can we deduce about legal principles? And so there's arguments as to why, for instance, to claim self-ownership doesn't exist is a performative contradiction. Because by claiming that there's no self-ownership, you had to use and control your own body even to create that argument. And so from there, there's actually, you know, certain legal principles. I would argue that, you know, the non-aggression principle and stuff like that is ultimately rooted there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just how it is. And for me, when I look at a society, it's effectively how well does it abide by this sort of natural law that we can glean from praxeological principles versus how poorly does it do it?
Okay.
And that's sort of the benchmark. So it's anarcho-capitalism as a toolbox for assessing how, I don't know what word to use, like orderly a society is. But that, even that has certain connotation because you say, you know, certain types of order are not exactly pleasing because, you know, if you have communists marching in a line or whatever. But I think you get my point.
Yeah,
how civilized, how flourishing of a society it's going to be interconnected to that.
So praxeology is going to be the next book I buy.
Well,
study.
Human Action by Ludwig von Mises is very, very good, although it's not an easy read. But Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard was originally written as a sort of easier to digest version of Mises,
right,
of Human Action, of just going, okay, we have these principles, how do we lay out economics from here?
So I'm about four chapters into For a New Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
I started that. I do the audiobooks. I get through a book quicker with an audiobook.
And are you doing the Mises one? So the Jeff Rickenbach doing the
No, voice, I've got the or? Audible one.
Okay.
That's what I found was quite tough with economics in one lesson. The audio, the guy narrating was very hard to stomach for long periods of time. I find the audiobooks better. Firstly, I'll get through a book quicker. You know, if a book's like it's a 9-hour audiobook, it'd probably take me 3 weeks to get through that. And then I'll put it down and sometimes I'll forget. But with an audiobook, I can do it in 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
But I also find I digest it more. I take it in more when it's read to me than reading it myself. I don't know if you ever have that thing where you're reading a book and you suddenly realize you've done 4 pages and taken nothing in and you have to go back.
Yeah.
I find the audiobooks better. Okay, so that's a very interesting. So I'll definitely check that out. But, you know, you've followed me long enough on Twitter to realize I like to dumb things down and just try and keep mm-hmm. things easier for people to understand. And the reason I do that, so for example, want the testing ground, back to the testing ground of Facebook, is trying to explain complex ideas in a way that people can digest them.
Yeah.
And I'm still not clear on almost, say Ron Paul had been successful. Say Ron Paul had amazingly won an election. Realistically,
praise be upon him.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll tell you something about that soon. But I really find the guy super interesting. I think he is one of the most practical politicians, if not the most practical politician I've ever heard speak. But if he had been successful, say he'd won the election, you know, what would have happened? Because I don't believe he could have instantly broken down and closed all the social structures that exist within government. So has this been debated? And do you have a personal opinion on what the, you know, the first 100 days in office or the first year in office, the kind of things, the kind of positive steps that would be almost let's go to marketing term, the quick wins,
yeah,
for changing the way politics works.
Yeah.
Because you can't get rid of everything.
I'll say that I reject the premises of this question.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
This question assumes that the only way to build towards a freer society is via the political route. and or like the explicitly like democratic political route.
So do you not vote?
The person, no.
So you reject?
Yeah, I don't bother with that. It's a waste of time. Statistically, it doesn't matter. I also, quite frankly, I don't know what it takes to run a Department of Defense. You know, as much as like I'm anti-war, I also don't know. You know, I don't know the details of how you would scale that back safely. I've never had experience, you know, wargaming, you know, at this high geopolitical level. So I'm not even qualified to be there. And if I'm not qualified to be there, I don't know how I'm also qualified to know who should be there. So okay. These are really complex questions that are kind of above my pay grade as just like a normal American guy. Sadly, I wish that I had some way to, you know, maybe give my input. But
is this discussed in libertarian circles then? Like, is the existence of a libertarian party antithetical to libertarian ideals?
It depends on. I mean, libertarian.
I know it's broad.
It's such a big tent term that it almost. I don't know. I mean, for me, I've never cared about the Libertarian Party. I was done with politics before I even learned about libertarianism, and only after the fact. I kept seeing Ron Paul's name on Mises.org after I'd been reading a bunch of Rothbard. And I was like, oh, he was one of us the whole time. That's cool. And in 2012, when he was running, I wasn't excited about Ron Paul because I thought he was going to win and, oh, we're going to go in. I mean, of course, I have my dreams of like, oh, we go in and we just get the paper shredder going, just industrial size and just every last tax code we just, you know, and law, whatever, we just start shredding. But I wasn't going to stake my hope in the world on that happen. I mean, we can see, you know, the concept of the deep state has suddenly become like a sort of normalized thing, such that, yeah, there's like some kind of thing. If this deep bureaucracy is keeping this thing going rather than just the figurehead, then putting someone in the figurehead position is not going to do much. They're going to get a lot of backlash and it's going to be very hard to get anything done. Now in the real world, you know, for the rest of us, not dealing with the inanities in Washington, let's go back to that fact of I think of anarcho-capitalism as a process, as this thing. It's not the end game. It's how do you work with what you have? What capital do you have available, and how do you accumulate more capital so you can get things done in your favor towards what you think society should be?
So you therefore live a life following your own libertarian philosophy, but within the constraints of the current law or how far you're willing to push the law. But it's almost like a personal practice.
Yeah. I reject like activism by and large. I think that people should focus on working and accumulating capital so that they can actually make change. And so what does this mean? Like, this means starting businesses. This means, you know, acquire Bitcoin is probably the greatest representation of this entire thing that I'm saying, which is why I'm so into Bitcoin, because not only does it encapsulate the process of you just create something to make change, but it's done completely without permission, and it strikes right at the root of the entire system. Like, as far as like the whole thing, everything we see around us that we don't like, there's a reason why people like us like always, oh, Bitcoin fixes this. Mm-hmm. It's because money is such a fundamental piece of civilization that it touches everything. When you start to poison it, it spreads. And so you're getting to the root of problems. That's not to say that like it's, you know, sound money is a necessary but insufficient condition for creating a sound civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But you get to that point. And it did not require, I mean, Ron Paul, you know, bless his heart, he was out there speaking against the Federal Reserve since the 70s, you know, and he was able to make a huge splash in the 2008 and 2012 elections.
Mm-hmm.
But that's still, we don't even get an audit at the Fed. We don't get anything. There hasn't been a lick of change in the entire Fed process, except the fact that we did get a lot of people who are now kind of open and like, we don't like this Fed thing. But even prior to Bitcoin, for me, it was like, okay, like maybe we just wait for this thing to collapse and then we all like hope that we have some gold or something. And
but Ron Paul is a good, I guess, a good marketing device for libertarianism.
A what?
A good marketing device for libertarianism. Yeah. More people would have been aware.
That's what I used him in 2012. Yeah. Is like, hey, like there's this guy, and by the way, like read Rothbard. But my point is like with he did that since the 70s. And yet, like, one guy, like, actually creates capital, you know, in terms of just, like, this actual working product that you can use. And it totally just obviates the entire debate. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't care about the Fed anymore. If anything, there's part of me that's like, yeah, please continue quantitative easing. You know, like, bring it on. Like, we've moved from, you know, like, Peter Thiel in Zero to One has his, like, indeterminate pessimism to determinate optimism. We've gone from that. We've gone from the indeterminate pessimism, like, I don't know when this thing's going to go bad, but it's going to go bad, and I don't know how, and I don't know how we're going to fix it, or whatever, to now a libertarian can go through the world. It's like, oh, I can just stack sats, and I am funding and I am building a better society. And so it's a very definite optimism of here's this route you can strike at and build a better world.
Next up, I talked to Michael more about libertarianism and the free market. But before that, I do have a message from my amazing sponsors. So let's talk about Kraken, the mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell and trade Bitcoin. They've absolutely killed it this year. I've had a few of them on the podcast. I've had Nick Pococo talking about security. I've had Nelson Minier talking about OTC desks recently. I've obviously had Pierre Rochard and Dan Held on. I love everything Kraken are doing. I love the way they're building out the most secure and best exchange in the market. But have you checked out their new app yet? Have you checked out Kraken Pro? Come on, it's time to check it out. They've crushed it. They've killed it with the design. It is a beautiful mobile-first only design so you can trade Bitcoin on the go. So whether you're in Starbucks getting yourself a salted caramel frappuccino, whether you're on a plane, whether you're at a concert and you're bored out of your fucking mind, it doesn't matter where you are. If you have the urge to buy Bitcoin, you can do it on the go with Kraken Pro. There is so much packed into it. You got real-time price updates, multiple charting and order book display options, advanced trading features. You can view a complete history of all your orders, trades, positions, deposits, and withdrawals. They've got fees as low as 0%, 24/7, 365 customer support. So seriously, if you haven't downloaded Kraken Pro, you need to really have a question with what you're doing with your life. So come on, join me in supporting Kraken. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is K-R-A-K-E-N-P-R-O. And next up, it's BlockFi. Yes, the amazing BlockFi, the future of Bitcoin and financial services, easily the best company within this sector. And if you listen to my upcoming show with Chua Demista, you're going to know exactly why a company like BlockFi is so important for the future of Bitcoin. They are building a suite of financial services with Bitcoin. They are helping mature the Bitcoin market. So if you need a crypto loan for your next holiday, or you want to get a Cybertruck with a flamethrower, or because you've got to pay the man, BlockFi's got you covered. And if you want to earn interest on your Bitcoin, you've got the BlockFi interest accounts, where they've dropped all minimum deposits. They've removed the early withdrawal penalty, and you can choose to receive the interest payment in the currency of your choice. I am a customer. I love getting my BlockFi interest every month. I'm sticking with them. But if you want to check them out, head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com.
I'm going to go back a step, because you said you reject all forms of activism.
I just, generally speaking, I don't think that, you know, waving a sign affects much. You might get a message out, I guess, but you also don't know how that message is going to be perceived, which is a major issue. And it doesn't actually change the substrates of civilization that we're dealing with. You know, like, when you accumulate capital, you now have something. There's something, I don't want to use the word tangible because we're Bitcoiners here, but, you know, there's some real change in your world and some actual control. When you have capital, you have more control over you and your surrounding, whereas activism is just, you know, waving a sign. And I, you know, that's nice. There's a lot of things that people are activists about that I certainly sympathize with. I just personally don't think that it's going to be any use to me, and likely not for them. It's up for them to decide for themselves, but likely not for them as well, to be waving a sign if what they really want is what some change that they want. So, like, you know, we can look at a lot of different, you know, kind of almost cliched examples of how the market has changed things. And I think a good example is Uber, where, you know, taxi monopolies are actually something that I used to complain about as a libertarian. And now, why would I ever think about taxi monopolies? Because someone actually went out and created the capital to create some alternative. And once that alternative exists, then people are just naturally, like, it's a better alternative. So just buy into that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this does take me into other areas. Okay, so the Uber example is really interesting. I just watched a documentary by a guy called Jamie Bartlett, who did the Missing Crypto Queen podcast, who I just interviewed. He also did a two-part BBC documentary called The Secrets of Silicon Valley. And he went out to India, where Uber expanded rapidly, and they were providing loans for people to get new cars for Uber, and so they could become taxi drivers, and it was all very good. But as the market grew, there became more drivers and not enough customers, and the rates dropped, and people ended up in debt, and there are a number of people who just committed suicide. So whilst I fully understand and like the libertarian philosophy of like free market, I sometimes don't think it fully grasps the human impact sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there is real human impact. So one of the things I definitely disagree with is for building regulations. I think human greed would lead to the disastrous build of structures. We saw that in China during the earthquakes, where like a number of buildings collapsed because they didn't follow the proper building regulations. And Ai Weiwei actually built he did a whole artistic piece with the wires from the fallen buildings.
I think there's actually a piece of his here in Austin, an art piece.
It's fantastic. We had a massive fire in the UK, Glenville, which was a building that had cladding around it. I don't know if it made the news here, but this a bit like you have projects in the US. These are essentially a council tower block. Now, they wanted to refurb it because these tower blocks are old and ugly. They put cladding around the outside. Mm-hmm. They used the wrong cladding. A fire started. The building went up in flames. I think 85 people died. So now they're going around looking at the buildings, looking at all the cladding in all these buildings. Now, correct me where I'm wrong, but the libertarians would say, well, you know, in a free market, if this happened, no one would use that company to build buildings anymore. But that doesn't ultimately protect people. Mm-hmm. Actually, the regulations in place weren't followed. Okay, I understand that someone broke the rules, but the regulations are in place. And if you speak to my uncle as a fireman, I'd say there's very specific regulations that are essential that save lives up front. And I sometimes think you can do the same sometimes with food as well. You know, the protection from certain foodborne diseases. Mm-hmm. I think in a fully free market, we don't fully appreciate human greed and the impact on life at the end of it.
Well, so I do disagree with that. Okay. But
you understand my concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And this once again, this goes back to like, oh, well, you don't want the government to be doing the law, therefore you don't like, you know, laws at all or something. But I think this is a little more nuanced because it's mm-hmm. saying that, you know, just unless you have that guy with a stick at some point, you know, beating them, like, they're going to find ways to cheat that do harm people ultimately, mm-hmm. Just because they want, you know, a cheap win.
And people can be fucking greedy.
Yes, absolutely. I think one thing to consider first off is that, you know, and you did point to instances of it, like part of this, there is a lot of government intervention in the first place. So, like, you know, I don't consider us living in a free market right now. Mm-hmm. There's many aspects of it that are very free relative to, you know, other economies, but it's not like America is a free market paradise. And I tend to, and this is a sort of libertarian bias, I tend to suspect that the government rot is much, much deeper than other people think. So it's almost like a Rorschach test where someone's going to look at it and it's like, oh, well, that's this happened because it was too free market. And I can look at the same thing. It's like, oh, this happened because there was too much government. So there's always going to be that Rorschach thing. But, you know, I was having a thought as you were saying that obviously India had this like very, there was like a sort of shock on the market as Uber came in. And it, like, this almost sounds callous. It sounds like Uber was just a wild success. It was seriously providing value to it such that it grew that big.
Yes, but they also, So they also had themselves. So one of the things I observed, so I interviewed Jamie about the series, and one of the things I observed within this, one of the, it feels almost abusive positions of Silicon Valley companies is they have such deep pockets, so much VC money, they can go into a market, operate at a loss,
right?
Squeeze out the yeah. competition, and then change the rules to their advantage.
Yeah.
And whilst that's still part of the free market, sometimes that's a kind of abusive.
So this gets to a couple of those cool. things that I wanted to get to. First off, I really get the suspicion that a lot of VC money is basically off easy credit. Mm-hmm. That is, to some degree, like the Federal Reserve prints money, ends up in the pockets of VCs. It's all, at the very least, the dollar becomes a game of hot potato where you just have to invest in stuff quickly to just get high returns very fast rather than like investing long term. The other thing is, like, you know, when you have that...
But that doesn't change the rules of the game, that they still have deep... Even without that, they would still have deep pockets.
Sure.
Still be able to go into a third world country or developing country and have much deeper pockets than the local market and squeeze out the competition and then ultimately drive capital back into the richer country. What you would say, if you believe in a structure, then you would say they are potentially abusive strategies.
I'm willing to like agree with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like I'm not trying to like defend Uber in this case or anything. I don't know enough about it.
Okay.
I'm just trying to like point out like what may be other ways of inquiring into this to get multiple perspectives.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, the problem, I can imagine a situation where the government has caused so much like rot and problems. They've stifled a society so much that when capital is injected like that, it can cause a bigger shock than it otherwise would have been. So that's perhaps another thing. The reason I brought up Uber was not necessarily because I want this like to talk about like viral Silicon Valley technology, but instead just the role of how society changes with technology, like that process. There's a really great essay that I've referenced a number of times called The Will to Be Free, The Role of Ideology in National Defense. And this essay comes up because in anarcho-capitalism, one of these sort of ultimate questions, when it really boils down to it, is national defense. How do you protect yourself from foreign invaders? Mm-hmm. And there's many different, you know, ways of thinking about that. Probably too much for this, you know, podcast or whatever, but this essay applies, I think, more generally than just national defense, which is why I bring it up. What Jeffrey Rogers Hummel argues in it is that basically right now the state is the de facto provider of national defense. We live in such a society that we have only accumulated so much capital that no individual really has the ability to compete with the state anyway. So they remain the provider of X service. However, as society does accumulate capital, become wealthier as a society, suddenly you can start competing. And what he argues is there could be a day when some individual organization has accumulated enough capital that they can provide an alternative national defense type, some security service. And when that goes on the market, if it's marginally beneficial compared to the old service, people will kind of naturally switch over.
A national militia.
I don't want to use those words because that's how you get on FBI lists. And that's not really... this is an example of something. I'm not arguing people, you know, go start that necessarily.
But again, I'm not sure how practical that is. Though. Like, I understand but the argument.
But this is... But what I'm saying is, like, for an industry that people associate with government... This can happen, and someone finally accumulates enough capital where they can just provide it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's better, people will switch over, because why wouldn't they? It's in their just simple economic interest. It's like, I want better service for less money, so I'm going to use this service. Now, if this continues happening and people switch over to that new service, then it's won. And those people are actually going to have a very hard time being told, oh, you shouldn't have that service. Which is actually interesting in this conversation where it's almost like it's actually difficult. Like, 10 years ago or whatever, if you told me like, okay, there's this company and you just get in some random person's car and whatever, yeah, that'd be absurd. And yet now you're having to like, you're having to tell me about some, you know, pretty potentially nasty stuff in India for me to sit and think like, oh, should I not use this service? That's how far the sort of ideology, so to speak, around that service has shifted. So I view this as happening. This is the sort of process of anarcho-capitalism for a lot of things, where you will accumulate enough capital where we'll just be able to outcompete the government where it fails. So education, I'm not saying that it's necessarily like a full replacement yet, but we have things like Khan Academy and Wikipedia, mm-hmm, that are really great. I wish I had them as a kid. I would, yeah, have skipped school all the time just to go sit and learn calculus and read Wikipedia. These things exist and they didn't prior, and now we can. And so it actually, it's not that Khan Academy doesn't necessarily like show you why we can just like have everyone not be in the public school system anymore, but it does raise the opportunity costs of being in public school. It's like, why would you be there for 8 hours a day when you could just be doing this and open yourself up to these opportunities? It changes that economic balance over time. And so this is, I think, a much more low time preference way of doing things. And it removes the politics, so you don't have to sit around getting upset about politics all the time. I'm hoping I hear as little as possible about the 2020 election, but you know, we know how that'll turn out. It'll still be surrounding me all day and all night.
Yeah. I appreciate the response. I'm not sure it fully dealt with the question of, I don't want to say monopoly abuse, because, mm-hmm, you know, Uber doesn't have a monopoly. You know, it's essentially a duopoly now with Lyft. But it's almost like there is a collateral damage. Some humans are collateral damage in a free market. It's like, well, yeah, there may be a human cost.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the human cost of government.
Of course. So no, I understand
like,
that.
That is like the one thing where it's, you know, like, I mean, we look at, you know, democracy and stuff, and we had how many tens of millions of people die in the 20th century at the hands of government.
So. Yeah, no, I don't disagree, but it still doesn't deal with it. And sometimes
I guess
why
the point is like, what are the actual like risk analyses of this? Now that's not me trying to be cold about human life. I cherish human life. I'm just like the actual risks, for instance, of, you know, how many people die in, you know, plane crashes, it's very, very low because there, you know, a couple people, you know.
But some people will.
Died, yeah. Like, but this is also, in a sense, at some level, that's inevitable. We can't live in a perfect world where no one gets hurt. So I just worry about, like, trying to use that too much to stop free market innovation. But because it's an intractable problem anyway.
But this is almost the crux of the debate going back to Facebook that I've had with people, is that when I'm there saying, you know, these socialist programs, they're dangerous because they don't consider the full economic impact, the view and the response is, oh, you're just wealthy and don't care about poor people and austerity has been awful and 187,000 people have died. And I'm like, no, I do care. I'm on the other side in this I'm in that argument. But I guess where I'm getting to is, like, I wonder if a fully decentralized human structure is best. So one of the things, the rabbit holes I kind of went down for a little while was, I was put in the direction by Francis Poulier, was minarchism. Is there some things that make sense perhaps to be centralized? No. So, for example, could maybe considerations for the impact of monopolies and abusive practices on people, or maybe building regulations are a good thing because they do save lives. Like, like I almost think, therefore, in the world of libertarianism, like, do we have to wean ourselves off these structures and say, okay, this structure works better centralized, this structure works better decentralized? Can you see by the way my mind's working?
Yeah, I think also this goes back to some of these, like, you know, terminology issues of like individualism versus collectivism and stuff. Libertarianism, partially because of most libertarian activists themselves, is very much portrayed as an atomistic philosophy, where it's like every man is his own island and all that. But if you go back to like the sort of, you know, praxeology of things, like the nature of, you know, political theory in and of itself, like at base, there's scarcity, so people have conflicts over scarce goods, and so thus they have to come up with ways of being able to come at peace with one another to raise up.
Okay.
With that in mind, like, we're, every man is not an island. So, like, when we talk about centralized versus decentralized, like, I don't think that it's really that... I don't think it's as... It's very much like a sort of spectrum, and I'm also not a central planner. I don't know where is best on that spectrum for all people. Mm-hmm. I have my personal preferences and needs where I would probably tend to be on more on the decentralized side, but there's some people it's like, I don't want to think about X, Y, and Z. I'd rather outsource that to a particular centralized institution. So I don't want to like impose perfect decentralization on everyone. I don't even know what that fully means.
And I think the spectrum helps the debate.
Yeah. And on top of that, like if I have a home, the value of my home is not merely dependent on me and how well I take care of it. It's also my neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so then you necessarily, even as a hardcore libertarian, have to be thinking carefully of what type of neighbors you interact, you live among, such as to like, if you want to have high property values, you have to have higher value people around you.
You collectivist.
So people, yeah. So I mean, there are people who would probably treat that as a collectivism, but we can also step back and look at how that so-called collectivism is also in line with self-interest.
Well, but I think the difference here is where somebody could live in that neighborhood and choose not to be part of what you're talking about there. It's almost like the difference between optional and forced collectivism. You know, taxation is forced collectivism,
right?
Backed by guns, yes. Whereas this is optional.
I think this is exactly kind of gets to the crux of it. Is like, are you having to participate because you want to or because you're forced to? And I will note though that if that person opts out and just does not, there's going to be a lot more consequences than they might even think. And I think those costs often get swept under the rug. Like, yeah,
they won't get an invite to the barbecue.
Not only not invited to the barbecue, like they're not going to get any benefit because people don't care about them.
Yeah.
And so they are choosing to be their own island, and that's going to have ramifications. And so I think those costs are, I actually do think that those are heavily underappreciated by libertarians. I think that's the side of it that they fail to understand. Because when they're talking about, you know, like all, you know, my drugs and all that, well, how do other people feel about living next to someone who does a lot of drugs? You know, like me personally, I would not be very comfortable living next to someone who does a lot of drugs. And so I wouldn't want to interact with that person. So there are social consequences.
Yep.
So I would very much say that libertarians do often miss the mark on that by ignoring those costs.
See, this is where I consider myself a moderate libertarian right now. I consider myself a right-leaning... I think it's myself right-leaning who cares for a social safety net to protect the most vulnerable in society being pulled by the gravity of libertarianism.
Sounds like a Nazi to me.
Yeah, well, it's complicated. I think that comes from growing up very much a socialist because I was a kid and I felt I had a heart and we should care for everyone and didn't understand the economics of socialism, to spending a lot of time in the States and spending a lot of time with more conservative people and hearing... I think American conservatives offer a much better structured, rational argument than British conservatives. I do. I think the problem with British conservatives is that they have this reputation of being toffs and have gone to private schools and very posh. Whereas in the US, a lot of Republicans I tend to find more tend to be like hardworking, but they still have similar conservative values. And so I've got a stronger... I like
some of those British guys there.
Yeah, they're like, interesting. But
Roger Scruton is a very interesting intellectual.
Well, we have the Eton structure, which is the big tough school which David Cameron went to. I'm not sure if Boris Johnson went to, but they're very out of touch with working class people. Whereas someone like Donald Trump, who is arguably very wealthy, who knows how he got it, but he's very much more in touch with the working class. So, but then, like I said, I'm feeling the gravity of libertarianism, but I haven't separated myself completely from the politics because if I believe the politics can lead to a better society, like I guess you're in the politics
car. If you have an example of like some time that you voted where it, you know, made your life better.
No, I'll give you a different example. So I'm half Irish. So my family's, my father's from Ireland. And a long history of troubles and violence about territory because of England, like going in and fighting a war with Ireland, and then, you know, a bunch of Protestants moving into Ireland. And if I get any of the history wrong, my apologies. But we have this issue with Northern Ireland, with the Protestants at war with the Catholics. We have loyalists against neo-nationalists. And I've just followed a fascinating seven-part series on YouTube called Spotlight on the Northern Ireland Troubles. It talks through the whole history. But what you follow is how it degraded into senseless violence, just murder. So it went beyond just, you know, car bombs against army structures, because that's considered war, to just outright murder. Ultimately, the deadlock of murder was broken by politics. The only way of solving it, the Sinn Féin eventually realised they were losing. They went to the negotiating table. The Good Friday Agreement was born, you know, sometime after they eventually got to power sharing. And, you know, that was facilitated by Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. And again, I may have some of this not entirely correct, but that was only achieved through politics. The end of senseless murders came through politics. So sometimes I recognize it. Sometimes I think, right, you need politics. However ugly and dirty it is, you need it to break certain deadlocks. Like the only way to break the deadlock between Israel and Palestine isn't Bitcoin. Yeah. Bitcoin doesn't fix that. That is politics. So sometimes I think you have to play the dirty game.
Yeah. Well, I think.
Is that a fair example?
Sure. I think too. Here, when we say politics, when I'm saying politics, I'm specifically speaking of like the democratic process of you go to the voting booth, you vote for the person, some figurehead somewhere changes, whatever. You don't escape politics completely. Humans are political creatures. Mm-hmm. We all face scarcity, and thus we all face conflict of some kind, even if it's just, you know, very small stuff or very big stuff. Like you don't escape the fact that we have conflict. Mm-hmm. The reason why we have private property and all of these libertarian theories in the first place is to deal with that fact that we are political creatures. It's sort of how do we manage that? So I don't disagree that, yes, like various politics, like you're going to have to sit down and come to agreements. You have to produce law to come to an agreement. But even then, what does that mean? What does it mean to produce law? You know, the modern people think that that means legislation. You vote the people in who create, they write down on bills what everyone has to do. And that's the, you know, law of the land or whatever. But then there's other, you know, like traditions, common law, where the law is not, it's actually more bottom up. The law is you and I come together, we're having a conflict, or we're about to enter a deal and we want to mitigate potential conflict in the future. So we write up an agreement and we find a neutral judge to look over that case, and that the contract itself becomes the law. So it's very much a bottom up process. And that whole process also, you know, comes up, it discovers the patterns by which humans can, you know, kind of continually to peacefully interact. Just, that is common law. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is present within a libertarian society. It's just having a territorial monopolist imposing taxation and all of that is not necessarily the best way to actually produce that peaceful prosperity.
But okay, I'm going to go to I think it's my interview with Balaji. He said, referring to the significant social networks up in Silicon Valley, I think mm-hmm. it was him who said they could end up becoming de facto heads of state with yes, the amount yeah. of power they
it's
have.
It's a great interview, yeah.
Yeah, it was. But they could end up becoming de facto heads of state. So couldn't they end up in a similar position in a free market whereby, I think I'm going around in circles here, whereby you end up having tyrannical monopolistic power without regulation?
Yeah. Well, and I think the you know, point that Balaji makes with this is trying to build capital towards making exit more easy, so that when you enter into Facebook or whatever, it's easier for you to also leave. And that's something that you can do as a preventative measure, especially like in cyberspace.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, like if you go onto Jack's, you know, fiefdom over at twitter.com, yep. which is a fiefdom I very much treasure, and you tweet on there and you don't make sure to back up your stuff, but then you say something that brings, you know, the wrath of someone at Twitter down on you, or the mob or whatever.
The leftist.
It doesn't even matter who, but it gets you shut down for whatever reason, and you didn't back up your stuff, everything was lost.
But you stand so by that as a private company, they have the right to do that.
There's lots of debates to have about that. My point is with, at least in cyberspace, you can just store that data on your own anyway, and so you don't lose your tweets if that goes down. Now, do you lose access to their other services and be able to continue broadcasting? Obviously. But you can still post them on your own website. You know, you still have the content. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand so what you're saying.
You still have, like, you know, it's obviously a very, like, unfortunate thing if you get kicked off Twitter, but that person can publish on their own website. And they don't, at the very least, they at least have their content, the tweets that they wanted to produce in the first place. That's, yeah. That's in many ways that undersells, like, the power of the Twitter platform. My point is that with technology, you can build these, you can start to build better exit such that if you have to go somewhere else, it doesn't hurt you as much. And that's what Balaji is getting towards. Like, and
so you say that, but exit to where? So, for example, Twitter for me is a central component of my marketing. I had a 12-hour ban. Now, the 12-hour ban in isolation wasn't a problem.
I got banned once, or suspended as well, one or whatever they call it. Yeah, because I told a journalist to learn to code.
Oh, I called a guy a mangina. I got a 12-hour ban for harassment. But. The warning sign was there. I was like, holy crap. I now have to consider my output on Twitter, which I don't do a very good job of, but I have to consider it, because if I was to be fully banned for Twitter, that would have significant consequences on the marketing of my show. So I have to comply, essentially.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying here, and there isn't an alternative. It's not like I can go to Gab and suddenly build up the same profile, or even Facebook. I just lose a platform. Mm-hmm. And therefore, what I'm saying is, sometimes I struggle to see the difference between the monopolistic power of a corporation and a government. They have very similar abilities, abusive positions.
The thing is, like, the state, in a way, is just a
is a monopoly.
You are. I mean, it's a giant corporation. It's just an extremely poorly managed one
and bankrupt.
Yeah. So it's a terrible corporation. But I totally get, like, why you see that. My point is, like, this whole thing, you should be just. Like, how do we build things to kind of get out of it?
But what I'm saying is, without government, mm-hmm. then would the monopoly step in place and start acting like government?
Yeah, but with government, you still got, you know, like, banned on Twitter. And, like, without government, Twitter could have banned you. Like,
yeah, but at least with government, you can therefore you can at least have the debate and say, is a Twitter ban, like, is Twitter a public service, and therefore is a ban right? Is it wrong? You know, you can at least, there is the threat of some form of regulation if something feels unfair. I'm struggling with, like, here, you can see I'm struggling with weighing which situation's better.
Yeah.
And I lean towards with you, and I lean towards the libertarian side. I'm just not fully there.
These are very difficult questions. Mm. I'm not even, I don't know the full answers to these. What I'm trying to get at is, I think that the road forward is, like, okay, well, how do you build stuff so that you, like, it doesn't matter about Twitter? You know, like, are there ways to build platforms that do not have this kind of power in the first place?
Well, and, that's interesting itself.
And we'll see if that's possible. But, like, to me, that's more interesting of a question than getting into the nitty-gritty of turning, like, Twitter bans into, like, this whole political process. Like, if it got to the point where speech was, like, fully under, you know, like, you know, democratic populist control, I wouldn't want to be on that kind of platform anyway.
I think it's already there.
I can imagine, like, ways it's moving there for sure. But, like, once it's, like, as it gets worse, like, I don't even want to be on there in the first place. Because it's obviously not going to be a very good place to share ideas.
Well, but you can't share some ideas. Like, so this came up on Rogan the other day. I think it was his interview with Matthew Taibbi, which is a fascinating interview, actually. And Rogan does some excellent things. And he talked about the fact that people are being banned for discussing things which are biological fact. We get into the trans area because you have this kind of march from the left to control speech. And so even having the debate on Twitter can see you be banned. And actually, that makes me think of something even more interesting. Do you listen to Eric Weinstein's new podcast, The Portal?
I've listened to a couple episodes, yeah.
So I listened to his interview with Sam Harris, mm-hmm. which was, it kind of got a bit pompous at times, and, you know, I this, I that. But Sam Harris said something very interesting in that. And he said, and I'm going way off on politics here, so we'll rein it back in, but I just think it's interesting. I think people should listen to it. He said the far left have the ability to control narrative where the far right doesn't. The far right narrative is usually rejected as insane and can't control any narrative, yet far left opinions can. And I just found that kind of fascinating. But that has bled into the world of Twitter. So as you know, Rogan said, there is a factual biological difference between men and women. But a trans woman, if you even want to have the debate that a trans woman is not a woman because therefore you want to protect people in the world of sports, you have the MMA fighter who cracks someone's skull, you can't have that debate now. And that's dangerous, I think. Yeah, so that's point one done. We're an hour and 12 minutes in.
Yeah.
So in essence, you know, Bitcoin has been an amazing tool, therefore, for you, for everything you studied previously. It really supports all your ideals with regard to libertarianism about the accumulation capital, which therefore, even though Bitcoin fixes this, is a meme that's kind of been overdone, a bit like OK Boomer now, it actually, there's a real fundamental truth to it.
Yeah, actually, I would argue it hasn't been done enough.
Oh, okay.
What else have we not uncovered that Bitcoin will fix that perhaps we didn't even know was a problem? I was talking to a friend recently, and I was telling him about the woes of modern architecture, and he had never even considered that. And so, like, you know, there's all these types of things that we go day to day living in our fiat world that is just trash, and we accept it because it's been normalized. But what if it doesn't need to be that way and we can actually have much better and sound money and the accumulation of that capital and having lower time preference, yada, 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 can incentivize people towards making better things? We don't even know what else is out there. So yeah, people use it a lot, but they use it a lot, I think, with good reason. Mm-hmm. And usually the responses to Bitcoin fixes this aren't like, oh no, it doesn't actually fix it because blah, blah, blah. Like people just respond with snark, you know? It's just like, why do you think that this has anything to do with Bitcoin? It's like, well, like how can we look at, like, let's actually step back and look how has the money.
But it's not actually about Bitcoin. Bitcoin's just the tool.
Yeah. I mean,
it's the ideology behind it.
It's the fact that low time preference is the process of civilization.
Okay.
You create civilization by having a lower time preference because you can accumulate more rather than just spending. In order to build civilization, you have to have capital. You have to have bricks. You can't build Rome without bricks. You know?
Mm.
So, like, you have to be able to accumulate those somehow. Having lower time preference is that delayed gratification that makes the whole thing possible. And if money, at its base, this entire fiat system is forcing us towards consumerism, which everyone hates, you know? Leftists don't like consumerism either. They call it capitalism because that's how they perceive. They see, well, there's the big businesses, et cetera, like, this is capitalism. I don't like it. I sympathize. Like, I don't like it either because I see how the fiat system has incentivized people to not be able to save at all. You can't save. You have to go invest money in stuff to try to get a quick return to beat inflation. And that's just to stay afloat, let alone grow in capital. So money is at the root of this. And if you fix that, then you can get right back on track to lowering the time preference of people in society. And as you lower time preference, you get the process of civilization and you build nice things.
It's a tough sell though. Like I get it now, 2 years in, being, you know, I'm not the smartest guy, right? Like, yeah. It takes me a long time to learn these things, but spending time with people like you and Pierre, you know, Eric Voorhees, really smart people, are kind of, I've got it almost through like the process of osmosis, right?
My personal strategy with a lot of people, and it seems to be effective. And of course, there is I'm low time preference. I don't mind if it takes you 2 years yeah. to come around to it. So, but I do like to, going back to like the Overton window concept, saying Bitcoin fixes this, money has never been discussed. You took all these economic classes. They probably never talked about how the Federal Reserve, like at least a perspective that the Federal Reserve would be, you know, decreasing the wealth in society or merely redistributing it or whatever. You probably never got that. It's just...
I was 39 when I first started learning about money.
Yeah.
At no point had my parents taught me about money, had no point
school. So just consider how far outside the Overton window bringing money into it is.
Yeah.
It's not because it's like, you know, shocking or, you know, racist or controversial, like bad in that sense, like, you know, icky. It's that it's just like, that's not even part of people's conceptualizations. So for me, what I've, at least it's both joyful for me and seems to be somewhat effective, is to go with that very shocking statement to just like shock people out of that Overton window and then gradually work them to like what that means.
It's almost like the shitcoin argument. Someone like Mr. Hodl will say, just let them get wrecked. Let them get wrecked. Let them see what's happened with Bitcoin and they'll learn about Bitcoin. It's almost like you have to let people get wrecked by fiat. You almost have to let that happen.
Like I
question money.
I sort of disagree with it.
Okay.
I get the mindset.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, like I don't expect to just like win everyone over. So if I lose a few too, that's fine. Like what I care about, I care more about, you know.
But I'm the Bitcoin guy on Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And I am trying my best to be, explain things, share things. I can't, no one's listening. All they care about is like 2 years ago when number go up.
Something I like, well, number go up is great,
yeah,
for one. Especially like even when the market, like right now, like there was a dip and people freak out, you know, because like, oh, it's under 8,000.
It's dead.
Yeah, yeah, they're all doing that. But, you know, I have such a joy showing people the log chart and showing them how like actually we're just right on track.
Mm-hmm.
If you can show people, numbers still go up. Just you were just looking at the wrong time frame because someone was scamming you with the news cycle or
change your, you know, time, whatever. Preference.
Yeah. So yeah, I love showing them the long, you know, the all time log chart and show them how that differs. So there's the number go up meme where it's like, no, numbers like that, because, oh, I thought that was dead because they heard about it in the news when it was 20,000 and then went down, yada yada yada. And it's like, no, it's still alive, and it's actually better than ever. When you actually look at the economic fundamentals, like, number go up, like, and the number is going to continue to go up, and, you know, stock to flow stuff, if that's correct, like, number is really going to continue to go up.
And if you show the reverse chart, the dollar to Bitcoin chart, number go down.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. The other one, like, stuff like Bitcoin fixes this, that's a very personalized meme. If you're like me, and you sincerely believe that money, fiat money, has soiled everything it touches, which is everything,
yeah,
then everyone has problems and there's going to be something that you can, you know, tap into. So for instance, like the architecture, there was someone else I'd been talking to that they were an architecture student. And I was talking, they were talking about like sustainable architecture and stuff like that. And I know enough about architecture that I can kind of bloviate about it. And talk about how I believe that the time preference is an issue in architecture and how traditional modes of architecture, pre-fiat, basically, were actually more sustainable than all of the nonsense that they go on about today. And I was able to like jumpstart this conversation and tie Bitcoin back into it as just this monetary tool, this like fundamental civilizational substrate to power that. So that is one of the real benefits of the Bitcoin fixes this meme, highly personalizable.
And it's, you know what? It's the meme of 2019. Like, it's owned it. Like, it's fully owned it.
Yeah.
It has created a discussion. Have you prepped next year's meme?
I'm working on something.
You're working on
something? Yeah. So I don't go to a lot of conferences. BitBlock Boom is actually basically the only one I go to. Because I just have to drive up I-35 to get there.
I've got high expectations now. I'm going to come next
year.
Well,
everyone, I think everyone is going to have high expectations now. So I gotta think of something equally controversial.
It's your tough. It's the tough second album.
But with Bitcoin Fixes This specifically, that's specific. We have to give a shout out to Stefan Lavera.
Okay.
He was He was the first one to just utter those three words.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Oh, so you co-opted.
At least in the. I mean, maybe someone said it prior, yeah, but in this like modern, this 2019 memetic form.
Right.
Yeah, it all came from Stefan Lavera.
I didn't know that. I thought it was entirely you.
No. I was stating the state of memes.
Big up to Stefan.
Yeah. I'm a huge Stefan Lavera fan.
Me too. Actually, me and him chat a lot in the background. He's been very helpful to me. I think I've been helpful to him as well. But like, I'll pick his brain on like Austrian economics, and then he'll pick my brain on marketing. But like, his show has been really helpful. Actually, my favorite show of his, I keep telling him this, was his solo show. You'll see me.
Was this
to
the beginner's Austrian economics?
Yeah. I wish he would do more of that stuff. Yeah. Like, his solo show is the only one of his shows I've listened to twice, and I wish he'd do more of them.
Yeah, it's been interesting because when I first got into Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin was the, as we said, like perfect incarnation of everything I believe. Mm. You know, like all the memes, like the maximalism, all that stuff, that's rooted, like I was already like that prior to Bitcoin. Bitcoin was just the perfect embodiment of it. You know, before that it was like gold, right, except I also had my doubts about the gold standard actually taking off. Like, how do you actually make that happen? Mm. Bitcoin creates a practical path. But all these beliefs existed. And I had this feeling when it started, it was like, oh, you know, Bitcoin's going to turn everyone into an Austrian, you know, and that's just the way it's going to be, and that's going to be great. And then, you know, this is 2012, 2013, and years pass, and it's all the shit coins, the Scambrian explosion, and then just on and on with the ICOs, and it's like, okay, I guess not. I guess we're all just going to be a bunch of Keynesians still until this thing collapses.
I think it's pretty amazing where we've got to, though.
Well, and now everyone is just absolutely, they have a ravenous appetite for Austrian economics, and it's incredible. Mm. So it actually, like, for me, I was in the Austrian economics, and it brought me to Bitcoin. And for people, it really is. There's some subset of people where the Bitcoin does bring them to Austrian economics, and now there's tons of people wanting to learn. And I think those people are going to have their eyes open, just like I did, to all of the ways in which bad money and bad governance has just, you know, made society way less than it could be, is probably the best way to put it.
Well, listen, look, this has been fascinating. You know, I said to you before we started, I haven't fucking touched any of my list, by the way. There's all this shit here that we've not talked about. Always the best way. But I said to you beforehand, I said, I can't believe I've done 170 shows and you've not been on. But I also kind of like a little bit believe in synchronicity. Like, things happen sometimes at the right... I think this has happened at the right time. I think the fact that it's happened after a... You know, essentially I've spent 15 hours in a car listening to economics in one lesson and a whole bunch of Tom Woods, you know, kind of like trying to consume all that and, you know, not having the past someone like you've had. So I've come at the right time, I think, with the right questions. I hope they've been useful for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, you bring good... It's actually been like a long time since I've really had to defend libertarianism because I just kind of swim in it. You know, it's just my world. So I don't even... At some point, you stop thinking about things as rigorously. And so you're bringing up, you know, good questions to reconsider. You know, it's been a while, like, oh yeah, how do you? And then once you do reconsider, it's like, well, maybe those old answers I had anyway aren't even the best ones to address it with. So,
well, I think
it's actually very good to hear your questions now.
And I do this with everyone. I do it with safety and yourself, Pierre. I kind of think of my show as a bit like, I don't know, like the Taylor Swift of Bitcoin. We've got you and Pierre do an amazing show. Trace does an amazing show. Stefan and Marty both do amazing shows. Like, I kind of consider mine a bit like... I try and ask the questions I think other people would be. Like, you guys are all there. I'm not, and I think a lot of people coming in aren't. And so they're the kind of questions I ask. So, like, I really appreciate that you give the time to do this because I do get a lot of feedback. I know this show's going to go out and a lot of feedback's going to come, and there's going to be people who are going to agree with you, and there's going to be people who are going to disagree with you, and there's going to be people who agree with me, and then there's going to be
all the haters.
Yeah, and they're going to say, oh, you're so dumb, McCormack. Oh, you still believe in part of the state, so you're a statist. All that shit's going to come. But I know these shows help. So, like, I massively appreciate you coming on. I've, like, really enjoyed this one. I mean, we've crashed through 90 minutes without touching a bunch of this stuff. But it feels like a body of conversation.
We have room for, you know, the second episode, yeah. Whenever you want me.
Yeah, I don't know what it will be. Well, I'll have listened to another 200 Tom Woods episodes by then. So I'll be like, yeah, we need to go through this again. All right, listen, let's close out. Tell how people to follow you. Tell them about the Nakamoto Institute work as well. Just tell them about everything, and then we'll close out, man.
Yeah, well, first of all, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Bitstein, Bitstein. You can listen to the Noted Bitcoin podcast, yeah, with Pierre Rochard, and that's at noted.org. We're also on SoundCloud, iTunes. I think there's a couple that we don't end up on, but you'll find us out there. And yeah, the Nakamoto Institute is what we founded back in 2013 as a way to catalog the public writings of Satoshi, as well as the cypherpunk history and literature that was built upon that whole world, as well as economic analysis, you know, now that Bitcoin exists. And you can find that at nakamotoinstitute.org.
Amazing. Brilliant. Look, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, so what did you think of that? Did you enjoy that show with Bitstein? It definitely helped me with a bunch of questions I have regarding libertarianism, but it still leaves many questions unanswered for me. The more I learn about libertarianism and what it means for freedom, the more I like it, but I still struggle with some of the considerations for human nature, especially around greed. So I'm not fully anarcho-capitalist yet, but I definitely appreciate some of the things I'm learning about. I love all these new things that I've been learning about since coming into Bitcoin, and the time and patience people have given me in helping me understand some of these concepts, you know, whether it's libertarianism, time preference, or Austrian economics. You know, I do appreciate the patience that people have shown, and I do appreciate Bitstein's patience during the interview as well. He was very good with me, very good explaining concepts I didn't know, I didn't fully understand. So thank you, Michael. Appreciate that. Okay. Hope you enjoyed the show. You know, as ever, if you've got any questions, you can email me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And also, I say this every show. I've done this since I launched the podcast. But look, thanks to everyone who supports the show. It doesn't matter what you do. If it's a review on iTunes, if you're a sponsor, if you share the show out with your friends and family. Everything you do to help promote the show helps me. So thank you so much. If you do want to do something to help, then check out my website. It's whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. That'll explain everything you can do to help. Okay, as I said, I've got a couple more interviews today here in LA. I'm off to see Lynn Ulbrich tomorrow to find out how Ross is. I'm going to record a show with her for Defiance. I'm then going to be heading out to either Austin, Florida, or Boston. I'm not sure yet. Depends on who's available for what interviews. I'll be back in New York for a couple of days and then back home. Next month, I'm heading out to Uruguay for La BitConf, and I will be going via Buenos Aires, hopefully. I want to check out Argentina. I've never been. So anyone out there who wants to hang out, do let me know. And as ever, if you got any questions, feel free to hit me up. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com.